Hey there, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here with Polar Levine, a.k.a. Polarity One, on News Dissector Radio, a weekly radio show on PRN based in part on the blog I write every day at newsdissector.net. You can join us on the phone at 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. We have an interesting program for you today because our guest, coming all the way from California, is none other than Norman Solomon, who you might have heard a few days earlier on Democracy Now! In a debate. We're going to hear more about that. We're going to ask him about it. As we discuss, you know, the situation right now, 10 years after the Iraq war started, the new wars that are taking place right now. And just as we meet, there's a new development, news development that I wanted to tell you about. John Brennan, who is being in Congress, the CIA nominee to take over the CIA, he's apparently, the hearing he had has been shouted down by protesters. And Senator Dianne Feinstein has cleared the room. The next time she says we do this, we're going to bring him back people one by one. Another protester immediately began shouting. She cleared the room. The hearing has been recessed. Earlier, he had defended drone policy, the drone strike policy, as legal and essential to national security. The president, he said, has insisted that any actions we take will be legally grounded. Morally grounded, I don't know about. But at any rate, that's the latest from Washington, and we'll be commenting that on that in a minute as Norman joins us from California. But we want to begin with an appropriate song, which was written at the time of the Iraq War by none other than Polarity One.
Fix that technical problem.
Tick tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC, NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Ivan, thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Trying to turn politics and the serious issues of our life into entertainment.
Managing the message.
Thank you, sir.
All the networks wanted to have was...
Thank you, sir. Norman Solomon, did you hear that? I think that's a very incisive way of remembering what went on there, because the war was an interplay between the policymakers and the media masters, who basically promoted their view of the world and didn't allow another view, really, very much airtime or space to be heard. And so here we are, still sort of frozen out of most mainstream media, but fighting back as best we can. And you were on with Amy Goodman the other day in a discussion with Colin Powell's former assistant. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, from Lawrence Wilkerson. And by the way, it's great to be on the air with you here, Danny. Lawrence Wilkerson was the chief of staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell, and he stayed in that position till 2005. He has claimed credit or blame for writing the basic script that Colin Powell read at his now infamous presentation to the UN Security Council on February 5th, 2003, which turned out was 6 weeks before the invasion of Iraq. And so yesterday was occasioned by this week bringing the 10th anniversary of that speech. I think arguably, Danny, perhaps the most dangerous, destructive, and disreputable speech given by a U.S. diplomat in the last several decades, and that's saying something.
So here we had Secretary of State Colin Powell sitting on a chair on the Hill, and behind him was the director of the CIA, who could have been actually his puppet master, basically with alliance, basically suggesting that we were being threatened by Iraq. Iraq had these dangerous weapons or these dangerous chemicals, and that action was necessary. And, you know, the truth, the facts, didn't have much to do with the presentation, did it?
Well, what's mind-blowing is it's so easy to forget what a tremendous waterfall and avalanche of praise greeted Colin Powell's speech to the UN Security Council in New York 10 years ago. And just, you know, not only Fox News type of media outlets, we're talking the New York Times, the Washington Post, on the front page, on the editorial page, the editorials by these esteemed newspapers. When you go back and you look, not only did the Washington Post, for instance, with its lead editorial speaking for the newspaper itself, headline their editorial with the word irrefutable and saying that the issue was settled, that weapons of mass destruction definitely were in the possession of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. But then when you go to the flip page, the opposite page of opinion that day, you had three columnists, two of which are still with us, Jim Hoagland and Richard Cohen, and then one who has since passed away, the usually sensible but not on that day sensible Mary McGrory, and all three of them were in total accord saying that Colin Powell had made a convincing case. And so it went. At that point, all dissent was basically excluded from the mass media frame, and it was off to war.
Let me just invite our listeners to listen in a little bit, because after, the colonel, Mr. Powell's colonel, Wilkerson, spoke, you were interviewed by Amy Goodman, and you got a little testy there. You got a little upset. Let's hear what you had to say, and then I want to ask you about it. We're trying to go to a clip here of Norman speaking.
Today we've got to look at the reality that we are in a repetition compulsion disorder cycle. After Powell spoke at the UN, Susan Rice, the current UN ambassador from the United States, immediately praised it as a statement from Powell that proved weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We had bogus hearings from now Vice President Joe Biden, who chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, excluding testimony from those who had contrary information that would challenge the push to war. We've had John Kerry, now Secretary of State, who voted for and propagandized on national television for the invasion of Iraq. So let's look at where we are. Tomorrow, a hearing for John Brennan, who is being pushed as a CIA director, someone engaging in aggressive war, the use of drones and so forth. And let me say that my colleagues at RootsAction.org are asking you to sign up at RootsAction.org to challenge that nomination.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Here we go. And Wilkerson came back to you and came back at you. But here we are. We're still debating something that took place 10 years ago and still refuting, or feeling the need to refute the facts, on the ground, so to speak, the facts on the Hill. Colin Powell's claims, and refute those claims as if reality hasn't done a convincing enough job of shredding all of it and showing the level of intense propaganda that we were subjected to, with the full complicity and enabled by all of the media outlets. It wasn't just Fox News, as you were saying before. This went across the spectrum of media. And this is why I'm a little troubled when people who are progressives focus almost entirely on trying to prove Bush did it. It was bad. The Bush administration was bad. And don't really give equal anger, equal vehemence to the role the media plays. Because without the media playing, the supporting role here, I don't think Bush could have done anything.
Yes, absolutely. It's a tandem. It's a combination of the news media and the powers that be in government that need each other. And they can't do what they do without each other's support and mutual tango. If you look at the way in which news media rely on and amplify official sources, and you look at the way in which those sources utilize the news media, an example would be in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, you had people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld going on the Sunday news shows and saying, don't just take my word for it. The New York Times front page today says that there are aluminum tubes that are for nuclear weapons that have been developed by Iraq. The front page of the New York Times just reported that Iraq is seeking uranium.
So it's symbiotic, isn't it?
And it's symbiotic, and part of the flip side of that is the New York Times got those lies from those very government officials who then cite the New York Times as legitimizing their lies.
So here we are, you know, Norman, all these years later, recognizing that power in America is not just a power in the office of the president or the political powers, but in the corporate offices of our media giants who in essence, play ball with and support these aggressive wars and the like. We're seeing it right now in terms of the drone policy. Despite the protests in Washington, it seems likely that John Brennan will be confirmed as the next CIA director and somebody who seems to be a total operative and functionary.
I'd like to add a third factor in this, and that is, where were the people? There were a few anti-war demonstrations and a few, you know, what, two or three in New York, and that was about it. Where were the people?
Pollard, there was the biggest demonstration in the world going on before the Iraq War, worldwide, millions of people in the streets in London, Paris, Italy, everywhere. I mean, in the United States, it was a gigantic demonstration here in New York. It wasn't just New Yorkers, but the demonstrations tapered off.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, we were both at the one in New York, but where was the entire uproar? I think there was a lot more in Europe than there was here.
Norman, thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there was certainly an outpouring, and for a while, but unfortunately it didn't last on a large scale, there was quite an upsurge in the fall, and then it was February of 2003, by U.S. standards, quite large, not just in New York, but elsewhere in the country. But the reality of the war was not met with the needed reality of protest that should have, rather than tapering down, should have escalated as the war moved into practice rather than just agenda setting. And I think the chronic problem is that it becomes a fait accompli. And our political culture on the street in our communities is, when push comes to shove, largely to defer to the de facto power of the president. When the troops go into war, then the media adrenaline goes into high gear. And let's face it, and Danny, there's nobody in the country who knows this better than you from both sides of the camera, knowing how it is at these networks. Once a war starts, the adrenaline that kicks in is tremendous from the news channels and the reporters, and they convey that on the air. I would say that there's an excitement when the cruise missiles land in the opposing countries like Iraq or Afghanistan. Our media get very excited, convey that excitement, and for a while it seems to take over.
You know, at the same time, when years later media executives sort of apologized or purported to apologize for the one-sided nature of the coverage, those apologies were basically buried by the same institutions that were engaging in you know, all of this anti-truth-telling at the time.
Yes, absolutely. And in addition to semi-sort of apologies about the quality of their own coverage sometimes, there's a lot of scapegoating of the Pentagon. And that happened after the Gulf War, where a number of weeks after the Gulf War, the several weeks of intensive bombing of Baghdad and so forth, network executives in the United States sent a letter to the Secretary of Defense saying, we should have had more access to what was happening on the ground, as though to say that the Pentagon had forced them to give such crappy coverage. Well, of course, it's true the Pentagon and State Department and White House try to control and constrict the coverage, but it's also true that the news media aren't forced by the government to have a steady parade of generals and colonels and admirals and sympathizers, suck-ups to the Pentagon, sitting in the studios giving the commentary. And so it's a mutual scapegoating that doesn't really deal with the question how we need an independent news media and how we don't have them.
You know, I'd be interested to know, I think our listeners would as well, who have read your work over the years, Norman Solomon, how did you become a media critic? How did you move into doing this kind of work and doing it with such intensity over so many years? It has to be, I know for me, myself, it's sometimes very frustrating when you feel no one's listening.
Yes, it certainly has its frustrating downs in the ups and downs of the work. Well, I'm 61 years old. I came of age during the anti-war movement of the late 60s and early 70s. And as an activist, I certainly noticed, as so many of us have, that we were not getting adequate or fair coverage in the news media, that the issues that I was concerned about were getting short shrift or distortion on TV and radio and the newspapers with very few exceptions. And also, I couldn't help but notice that when I actually had firsthand experience with an event or I witnessed the event, so often if I saw news coverage in the mass media, it was spun, it was slanted. And so I began to think about the institutional factors and the ways in which and the reasons why this coverage was being so slanted. And then I actually worked as a journalist, often freelance for Pacific News Service and for other outlets, and was briefly a correspondent for Pacifica Radio out of Moscow. And so I began to do a lot of writing about these issues and also reporting as well as commentary. And then became acutely aware from somewhat inside of the media profession how many constraints exist. And I began to learn about the great media criticism done by Upton Sinclair and George Seldes and I.F. Stone and others, and that inspired me as well. I remember at the age of, must have been about 21 years old, I went to the Republican convention in 1972 in Miami Beach.
I was there, too.
I experienced the protests, and I saw the great protests in the streets. I saw the contrast with the coverage, and I remember reading in the Boston Phoenix by the news dissector, Danny Schechter, in late summer of 1972, this really, may I say, brilliant analysis of what was going on in the streets of Miami Beach, in contrast to the media coverage. And so, Danny, you were somebody who really helped pave the way for a lot of media criticism and understanding, I think, in this country.
Thanks, Norman. And you've done two other things. In addition to critiquing media, you've actually tried to inject other voices into media with the Institute for Public Accuracy in Washington that you, you know, helped create. Tell us about that work and what you've tried to do and how has it worked?
Yes, well, in a sort of a grotesque way, the Heritage Foundation, that multi-million-dollar operation, every month spending millions of dollars to spin the news as a so-called think tank from a right-wing perspective, the Heritage Foundation served as a kind of inspiration to me because I did a story for the magazine of the Media Watch Group, FAIR, the magazine Extra, in the mid-1990s about the Heritage Foundation, and I did interviews. Of course, it was started by the right-winger Coors with some seed money. It was at that point the most quoted and sound-bitten think tank in the country. It was part of scripting the right-wing agenda of the Reagan administration after it took power. And so as I researched and wrote about the Heritage Foundation, I thought, wow, the right wing really has this thing cooking. Why can't progressives do this kind of activity? And so with the help of a seed grant, I was able to found the Institute for Public Accuracy during the last couple of years of the Clinton administration. And we're now 15 years into doing the daily work from the website accuracy.org, from sending out news releases, about 250 of those releases a year, to about 10,000 producers, reporters, and editors with each release, to offer alternative sources of information, commentators, analysts, researchers, activists, who can share different perspectives, shed a different kind of light on a whole range of issues.
So this is further evidence that, you know, there is available a whole stream of very well-informed, analytically sound kind of suggestions and analysis of what's going on, and that media outlets know about it, but then in some instances or many instances choose not to tap it. So there's a further example of how tilted, you know, our news is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really stunning to begin to realize and keep rediscovering how much talent there is in our country, progressive, open-minded, independent, not in the thrall of corporate media, or you might say the military-industrial media complex. And those folks are available. Some of them are in academia. They're in media themselves, often with their talents suppressed or squished or constrained. They're researchers, think tanks, activists. They're on the ground doing all sorts of organizing and creative political activity, civic engagement. And they're combining often analytical theory and research with practice, which is the best way to inform and enhance the understanding both at a theoretical and practical behavioral level. So these are folks that the Institute for Public Accuracy has been able to tap into, and I think it's a cause for optimism because we have tremendous people power in this country. But as you mentioned, Danny, at the top of the hour, we do the best we can, but we are up against horrendous obstacles.
You know, one of the stories that I quoted in my blog this week from the Institute of Public Accuracy in the aftermath of the blackout at the Super Bowl. And and you were the only ones who talked about the overall problem of the infrastructure in New Orleans post-Katrina and power shortages there. You know, that this was not a surprise. And many people, in fact, who were knowledgeable about the electricity capacity of the Super Bowl expected something like this or worried about it. And to my knowledge, you know, you had the only kind of suggestion that this was a valid story. It didn't seem to appear anywhere else. Everyone else was obsessed by Beyonce more than, you know, what actually happened in this incredible blackout that took place in the most watched football game, you know, in America.
Well, this is literally and symbolically, I think, an embodiment of what we're up against, where, as you say, Beyonce is at one pole of the media fascination with the superficial and the glitz, and then the reality of what people deal with on the ground. On the Institute for Public Accuracy release you mentioned, we had Makani Themba, who's been working on the issues that so badly affect people of color, low-income people in this country. And it happens so predictably with so many problems, not only the aftermath of the largely human-induced catastrophe of Katrina along the Gulf, but more recently with the Superstorm Sandy and the aftermath today of people in some parts of the greater New York City region who are disadvantaged in terms of getting their electric back, getting their utilities and services restored. And as we know, there's just so many ways in which race and class are disadvantaging some people in a way that's so profoundly anti-democratic. And, you know, I think often about, you know, our generation born at the end of World War II in general or within 10 or 15 years after the so-called baby boom generation, we largely grew up initially with a lot of idealism, and because of coming to terms with reality, that idealism has often been badly damaged and frustrated, and so we are struggling to maintain and hold the lantern high with our idealism and not to sugarcoat the reality, because in many ways in this country it is very ugly.
You know, Norman Solomon, you've done two other things that I want to give you time to talk about. Please stay with us into the second half hour here. Talk about Roots Action, your new grassroots initiative you, Jeff Cohen, and others have taken, and also about what it was like to run for Congress up against the Democratic Party in Northern California. You came very close. You didn't win, but you did have the guts to actually get into the electoral arena and challenge the powers that be there. And I'd like to hear that story as well. So as we move to a break, I just want to invite you also to hear Polarity One's song about the news media, a song that he wrote for the Media and Democracy Congress called News Goo. Here it is.
Wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
20 sound stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communicate.
syndication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say, we don't have anything to do.
Selling attitude like food for the masses. Junk consumption, we are lumping. Just a bumpkin to the corporate state. You can't satiate what you can't negotiate. Your will's been snatched, the bill's attached. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby?
Just hand me my old Martin, for soon I will be starting back to dear old Charleston far away. Since Roosevelt's been reelected, we'll not be neglected. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Back again.
Back again.
Back again.
Back again.
We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Since Roosevelt's been elected, moonshine liquor's been corrected. We've got legal wine, whiskey, beer, and gin.
Yeah, that was the New Lost City Ramblers, a national treasure from the. They started off in the 50s and they were still playing right until recently when Mike Seeger, one of the original members, half brother of Pete Seeger, died. Tremendous group who learned all the original arrangements of a wide range of country songs back in the 20s and 30s and recorded them in about 10, 12 albums.
But we're playing it also because Franklin Roosevelt, unfortunately, is not coming back again. And many of us feel the need for Franklin Roosevelt. And, you know, the closest thing we have to Franklin Roosevelt coming back again is Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon, who ran for office in California. And Norman, you know, a critic of the media, you know, somebody who's, you know, watched politics from a distance. Now suddenly you jumped into politics. What was that like? What was your experience?
Well, you know, in retrospect, and I campaigned nonstop for 18 months, which was, you know, beyond exhausting. I have to say it was one of the most wonderful and one of the most terrible experiences of my whole life. On the one hand, very inspiring. You know, I went at it from the outset believing that it only made sense if there was a real chance to win, and that was the basis upon which I jumped in. I've lived in this area for 15 years or so. For the first time in two decades, the congressional seat was an open seat. It's a overwhelmingly Democratic district. There's a lot of anti-war feeling here. And so we organized, trying to do it, and I think did to some degree do it effectively from the grassroots. And we ran on issues, and so it was a tremendous challenge. We have an open, what they call top two primary in California, meaning the top two vote getters, regardless of party, advanced to the general election. And I fell short by 175 votes, which amounted to 0.1% of all the votes cast.
Heartbreaking, but get into the nitty gritty of it, you know, for us. I mean. Yeah. You know, because what I think is brave is, going out there, knocking on doors, talking to people who may or may not agree with you, and try to persuade them and try to give them a sense that there is some other possibility in our politics.
Yes. Right. It was really a process of, for one thing, from my vantage point, getting out of what I guess we call the comfort zone. I mean, I'd never run for office. We're not bashful on the left, but it was very startling to me to see my face on posters, you know, because we try not to accentuate the persona and the personality or cult or whatever. But that sort of comes with the territory because your name's on the ballot, you're being, like it or not, somewhat marketed. But that said, I really tried to reach out and talk with people and hear their concerns, meet folks who really had no prior involvement or even acquaintance with progressive politics, and who may be identified as apolitical, as conservative, as centrist, as moderate Democrat, Green Party, Libertarian, or whatever. And meanwhile, I came at it, and still do in all my work as an organizer as well. And there's the usual partisan way that races are run by candidates, and I think that has certain strengths, but political organizing among progressives has certain strengths. And too often the twain shall not meet. You know, that progressives are idealistic but not necessarily real practical about gaining power, and the traditional politicians and their apparatchiks are focused on gaining power, but they're not usually too concerned about idealism. And so my effort was to try to meld the two.
And you did so with the support of a number of people who really came out and worked for you, including Phil Donahue, former talk show host. What a great guy, you know, to actually be out there with you, you know, early morning, knocking on doors, going to factory gates and all the rest of it, and others as well. Tell me about that campaign when people, you know, you weren't a big household name, you know, there. I mean, people on the left maybe know your byline, but they didn't really know you. And you had to, in the course of this campaign, you know, convey not only a sense of what you stood for, but who you were.
Yes, absolutely. It was a stunning challenge, not only because the district has 700,000 people in it, over 350 miles from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon border, but also to make that sort of human connection was so necessary. I mean, I was not surprised as an activist that the quality of the mainstream news coverage sucks, basically. But at the same time, we had to find ways to galvanize people in the various neighborhoods and communities. And so we had several hundred people who just generously, with their time and resources, often with their contributions and their energies, they donated, they volunteered, they put in really heartfelt energy going out to communities, passing out literature, talking to people. And as you mentioned, some high-profile folks really came through in just such a moving way as well. Phil Donahue took 5 days to go up and down the coast with me from morning to night, and I worked the guy really hard, and he was always so upbeat about it, because Phil Donahue is a real progressive. He's anti-war. We showed his film in every night of the trip, his film Body of War, his tremendous documentary about war. And we also had, as you mentioned, other folks. You know, Sean Penn campaigned for me. Maria Muldaur, who lives in the district, performed. Jim Hightower came out here and campaigned with me, as did 2 days before Election Day, Dennis Kucinich. And it was really moving to me how many people. Another example is Elliot Gould. We showed the classic film he was in, MASH, right in the heart of the district in Marin County, and Elliot Gould was there to talk about his opposition to war, which was really a cornerstone of our campaign.
Well, what I think, you know, what's impressive about it is it takes a lot of discipline to do something like this, because if you commit to a campaign, you know, and you're tired in the morning, you still have to get up and get out there. People are expecting you, are waiting for you. Campaign workers are, you know, dependent on your enthusiasm for their own, you know, inspiration and also their dedication to this effort. So it takes a lot of effort, you know, and a lot of work. To lose by 175 votes is a bad thing, but it's also a good thing, because that's how close you came. It showed in a way that there is, you know, a audience that's open to progressive politics, but that audience will never support progressive politics unless progressives go out there and try to organize them.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And people listening to us around the country, I encourage folks to think now rather than a year from now, when the elections are upon us. What's going on in your community? City councils, county boards, state legislature, mayors, Congress, are there people in office who are not doing the job you think they should be doing? Is there going to be a vacancy that might be a ripe opportunity? And are there people in the community who'd like to galvanize and perhaps find a candidate who can really embody their hopes for progressive change? And I encourage people to do that sooner rather than later, because there's a temptation to wait, and then last minute, kind of like in the supermarket, you see what's near the checkout line, like for the impulse items. That's too late if you wait until a couple months before the election.
One thing that's really brilliant that the Republicans are doing is that they're concentrating on local elections, and they're just taking over state houses, and that's where stuff really happens.
Yes, it's very important to be present in all those different community elections.
Well, you know, I think what we saw here was both an opportunity and a tremendous challenge to try to get out there and recognize that the ideas of the progressive community are you know, better than the ideas of their opponents, but are often not articulated in a way that people can relate to. And not, we don't need a lot of rhetoric here. We need people actually talking about the practical problems that people have, showing some compassion, some empathy, some, you know, concern about not only, what's wrong, but also what's right. I mean, we come out of a protest-oriented movement when actually what you did here was go beyond protest.
Yeah, I think it's right that how we're heard and the language that we use and the way that we reach out and build, hopefully, bridges with people who are very diverse is so crucial. And we can look at successes because we can create many more of them. And I say that the politics of denunciation is necessary, but so is the politics of reaching out, listening, and finding common ground, not by giving ground, but finding common ground that is really embracing of values that we share, which have to do with healthcare, education, housing, environmental protection. And when I think of someone like Bernie Sanders in Vermont, he's been able to take the language of the left and connect with people in human terms. And if we can defend Social Security and Medicare and job security and protection on the job and find ways for financing of public education and retirement and so forth, Bernie is able to articulate that, and so many other people are, but, you know, I'd say it this way. We do a lot of very difficult things, and elections are difficult, but it's more a matter of focusing than doing something that's impossible, because we can do it, but like anything else, you got to concentrate.
You know, one of the things that Bernie Sanders definitely understands and has a gift for, that, as you said, when you were talking about your running for election, that Democrats somehow seem to lack is reaching people emotionally, not just through rhetoric or through issues and details on issues, but there's an emotional aspect, and all humans relate that way, and it's the most immediate way to reach people who you may have absolutely nothing in common with, who may be bombarded by screaming freaks on right-wing radio saying that you're the devil incarnate, but yet when you speak to people in an intimate way, emotionally, they get you. They understand, and then they will hear the words.
I agree with that totally, and we so often forget that politics is not merely an intellectual activity, and in fact, the river that runs underneath and through our political behavior is so often emotional, and that's the human condition, so we ought to connect with it.
Now, one of the other issues that you've identified with is the way, you know, not just the right, you know, operates, but that some progressive or liberal, let's put it, Democrats, seem to be very willing to join, be opportunists at the, you know, drop of the hat and not stand up for their values and the issues. I think that's what's behind, in part, this Roots Action movement that you're also involved with. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Yes, Roots Action is 2 years old. We now have currently 210,000 people who are active, and we encourage everybody who's interested to go to rootsaction.org and sign up. We have several action alerts a week, and the entire project, and by the way, we are a 501c4 organization, so we're able to engage in political activity. The precept has to do with we need independence. We're progressives. We're not tied to any political party. We will support candidates and initiatives, but most of all, movements that have the values of environmental protection and health care and taking care of each other in our society and a sense of common purpose. You know, when I heard the New Lost City Ramblers singing about Franklin D. Roosevelt, that's the kind of president and government, New Deal government, that this country deserves, and we don't have. And the tremendous betrayal of the hopes of people by the Obama administration and the National Democratic Party needs to be challenged, I believe, and Roots Action is one of many projects trying to do that, not in a sectarian way and not in an impractical way. We believe that progressives should be able to gain and maintain power in a good way in government, and that means we've got to organize to bring it about.
So when you were running for office, did you have people from the Democratic Party come up to you and say, look, Norman, it's not your turn yet. You know, we think it's a wonderful thing that you want to run, but shouldn't you step aside right now, or maybe in the future we can re-examine supporting you?
Yeah, there was that kind of messaging from some Democratic Party officials that I should not criticize President Obama, that if I would be a bit more loyal sounding to the party hierarchy, perhaps something else would come my way, not for Congress, but some other office and that sort of thing. And it's just the way that it's supposed to work, according to the partisan hierarchy. But I come out of social movements, and so my orientation was very different, and it involved a lot of conflict in terms of the campaign. We had 12 candidates. One of them was anointed. He was in the state legislature. And it was just a very different approach than I think we need to make electoral politics meaningful for progressives.
So just let's go over one more time various websites and ways people can reach you, Roots Action, Accuracy, and the like. So, you know,
sure.
Because, you know, you right now you're in California, you ran for office in California, but you're not really a local yokel. You know, you're somebody who's been playing on the national stage for a long time with a message that resonates with people across the country. I mean, over 200,000 people in Roots Action just 2 years, I think, is impressive. Almost, you know, coming 175 votes short of, you know, winning a race. That's impressive. So tell us how they can be in touch with you.
Yeah, well, I can be reached just at SolomonProgressive@gmail. It's by email, but I have a website, just my name, .com, normansolomon.com, and you can sign up for personal emails that I send out a couple times a month at the top of normansolomon.com. As you mentioned, can also be reached through rootsaction.org. And also, the Institute for Public Accuracy that we were talking about earlier, I invite people to that site, which is simply the word accuracy.org, www.accuracy.org. And as we're talking about websites, before we wrap up, Danny, I really want to congratulate mediachannel.org for the relaunch, because it's looking great and it has so much that it gives to us every day.
It's been a real struggle to, you know, sustain, you know, a website that has a global orientation without, you know, the army of technicians and the, you know, financial support that you really need to do something like this. But we did get a team together who have really worked hard to get this website back up. We've gotten a great response to our initial mailing. Please check it out, mediachannel.org. My blog is at newsdissector.net. And you can you know, find out what's going on. We're also always looking for people who want to get involved, you know, who are not just readers, but doers, who might have some time to help with the marketing and promotion and you know, editorial selection, you know, of a website like this. So you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. This radio show is in the archives at prn.fm. You'll be able to hear it. We'll send you the URL, Norman. You can put it on your you know, website, where it can compete with Democracy Now. Just kidding. And people can check out this interview, because I think you've said some really important things here that we ordinarily don't hear. We're usually just issue-oriented. And, you know, you've added a personal dimension to this, told us a little bit about your motivation and your dedication, which I think is something that people have to admire and believe in. And, you know, in this respect, you know, I was very touched by your race for office, your willingness to take it on and get it on in a way that very few progressives have that kind of courage to go out there. You have to raise money. You have to be out there every day. And you did it. And I'm sure you may do it again. And the next time, the outcome might be more positive. So, you know, I think Norman Solomon is a person that you want to try to remember. You want to try to read what he's written. He's very prolific, both as a writer. How many books have you written, Norman?
It's been a dozen now.
A dozen. Well, I'm up at 15, Norm. You know, you got to work a little harder. But I'm just kidding. But, you know, the work that you've done is really important. And thank you so much for coming on with us today to chat with us. There's a couple of other issues I want to turn to. But thank you, Norman Solomon, for being here and joining us on News Dissector Radio. Impressive, isn't he, Pilar?
Impressive guy. Thank you, Norman. In fact, I want to try to get in touch with you. Maybe I can be useful with all the stuff you're doing, actually.
You know, his music is amazing, you know.
I'd love to be in touch. And thanks to you both. I really enjoyed the discussion. And I want to say, you know, in our lives, we are so blessed by our encounters with people who we learn from and who inspire us. And I hope that I'm sometimes told that I do that with and for other people. And, Danny, I want you to know that you have done that for me, ever since I was in Miami Beach as a 21-year-old in 1972, as they were tear-gassing us, you were doing the media dissection and the media analysis and advocacy, and that's part of the garden that we need to keep plowing.
It's amazing how many emails and notes I get on Facebook, for example, from listeners, former listeners at WBCN in Boston, who talk about the news at BCN and about the station and what it meant to them and how, you know, we need stations like that in America that are people-oriented, that are open to diverse ideas, that are willing to take on the powers that be, willing to stand up against the war, in that case the Vietnam War, but the wars that we're confronted with today. So, you know, people don't forget these things, and they do remember. And to me, the key thing is finding ways for us to collaborate and cooperate with each other, not compete with each other for a tiny market share, so to speak, but to actually, you know, try to find ways to strengthen each other and be generous in spirit in working for a better America. And that, to me, is very important. So
absolutely. That's our best future ahead. And many thanks. All the best to you both.
Thank you so much, Norman Solomon, for being with us. I just wanted to – we've had a guest on the program a few weeks back, Carl Mayer, a lawyer who's been fighting the battle against the NDAA, and he was in court confronting the Obama administration. Apparently a judges on the appeals court in New York threw out this NDAA ruling in a lawsuit brought by Chris Hedges and some others, and who are very concerned about the possibility of legislation that allows for indefinite detention. You get on some list and suddenly you're in jail for life with no recourse and no ability to appeal and no ability to even understand why you've been so chosen. You know, of course, you'll be labeled a terrorist and all the rest of it, whether or not you are. And so there was a court in New York was urged to reverse the ruling by the Obama administration. The Harvard Law School professor turned president is now fighting against Chris Hedges, former reporter of the New York Times, and as part of an effort to pass this onerous legislation of the NDAA. I have a video in my blog today, newsdissector.net, of the press conference that took place downtown. I was hoping that Kat Waters could join us because she was there to talk a little bit about this. But, you know, this is a really momentous thing that's going on with these drones defining our, quote, national defense, with cyber war. You know, I just written a piece for Al Jazeera about cyber war and secret directives signed by the president and all the rest of it. And we have a situation where Joe Scarborough, you know, called Obama like an American king who decides personally, you know, what our policy should be. This flouts, you know, the whole spirit of democracy. It's a very serious set of measures, repressive legislation, and edicts at the presidential level based on fear of terrorism, fear of cyber war, fear of American citizens taking action and being able to preemptively arrest people before they even do anything, commit any crime, because they may be thinking of committing a crime. At any rate, the New York Times today has a long story about this. Chris Hedges, somebody who's been on the show as well, who I admire. There's also a controversy within this controversy, because in his legal filings, Chris mentioned that he had some contact with the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party, implying somehow that they're terrorists, which, of course, they aren't. So, you know, this is a very complex a piece of legislation in which people can become informers against each other. And the president of the United States, rather than trying to expand internet freedom, expand free speech, is silent on important issues. Today, this evening at Brooklyn College, the group called BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanctions on Israel, is having a session with the co-sponsored by the Political Science Department. And there were people in the city, in the city council, were threatening to defund Brooklyn College because something's going on there that they don't like. And to his credit, Mayor Bloomberg actually stood up for academic freedom. So this is quite a controversy. It's going on right now. Please pay attention to it. Okay, thank you very much for joining us. Please watch, please come back to the show next week. Check out mediachannel.org, which is now back online. Final song is Mr.
The final
Maestro.
The final song is an updating of a song that Kitty Wells sang back in the 50s called It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels. And I sort of messed with the lyrics a bit and re-recorded it, calling it "It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Psycho Bankers."